Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Martin Freeman on two new films, Cargo and Ghost Stories, plus The Office, The Hobbit, and much more. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. We love our Brits around here. You guys know I'm an Anglophile. You know I love these guys. And, well, add Martin Freeman to the list. I mean, I already knew I loved Martin Freeman, but my gosh, in the next hour, I think you're gonna hear a love affair begin. Martin Freeman's great. This was such an awesome interview, a conversation, really. I mean, we really clicked and had a blast. And, you know, of course we all love Martin Freeman from his various, amazing different incarnations in his career he's had. He first came to fame, of course, in The Office, and he will always be linked to that show, and it stands the test of time. I could watch that show over and over again. But, you know, count, the Hobbit films, Hitchhiker's Guide, all the way up to and including, you know, his collaborations with Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg. He's appeared in all three of the Cornetto trilogy. Most notably in The World's End, and now in two new films for your eyes and ears. He's appearing in Cargo, which is debuting on Netflix May 18th, so check that out. It's a post-apocalyptic tale. It plays a dad taking care of his child in really extreme circumstances. It's definitely a tense thriller sort of thing. And also this great film called Ghost Stories, which is now out in select cities, select theaters, also on VOD. This is a great film, a really surprising, interesting horror film. Recalls the kind of the Hammer horror of the past. It takes twists and turns, kind of begins as a story about a debunker, a guy that's kind of debunking paranormal activities. And you think it's one thing, and it turns into something else. Martin is not necessarily the lead in the film, but he plays a very pivotal, surprising, interesting role. I highly recommend this film. It's already gotten great reviews thanks to its release back in the UK, and it's now out here in the States. So trust the reviews. This one's a special little surprising film for horror fans, for suspense fans. Got a great style, a bit of a good sense of humor to it, and Martin Freeman. So that's Ghost Stories. Check it out. Anyway, as I said, Martin Freeman couldn't have been more awesome. This guy is funny. He's smart. He acknowledges, we talk a bit about like sort of his reconciliation with celebrity and the downside to that. But, you know, in a very like knowing way, you know, he's the first to admit that these are problems that are not in the top 1,000 problems for a human being. But I was all the more delighted that we had this kind of great conversation, considering I know press isn't his favorite thing to do. But a smart guy, talented guy, and really open and interesting in this chat. So if you can't tell already, I'm the new president of the Martin Freeman fan club, and I have a feeling he will be not be a stranger to this podcast, hopefully in the future. As always, my solemn reminder to you, in exchange for this wonderful free content for your eyes and ears, mostly your ears, if you're watching the podcast, you're probably doing it wrong, is to spread the good word. Go on iTunes, rate, review, subscribe. It means a lot. And, I've been looking at your reviews. We've started to dabble in having some celebrities read reviews from time to time. That will continue. So there's a little bit more incentive for you. Write a nice little review, and who knows? A big-time, cool movie or TV star might just be reading it on a future podcast. I mean, the giving never stops here on Happy, Sad, Confused. And I give you this, Mr. Martin Freeman. Martin Freeman is in my office. We're playing games associated with my silly board of New Yorkers, because why not?
I love your children. Board of New Yorkers, because there's a lot of names on there.
There are a lot.
And what's good is you know all of them, or, you know, one knows all of them.
Yeah.
They're all proper names, aren't they?
And you can almost make them out from my third grade level.
That's your writing, is it?
Sadly, yes.
Well, we say writing. Cave painting.
I try to occasionally devote a little effort and just pretend to be an adult, but why bother?
How many of the, like, see, how many of those people, yes. If you were going to be honest,
yeah.
Or even, yeah, as if you would tell me, because there's a microphone.
No, please.
How many of those people do you think you have had at some point a crush on?
Oh, a crush on?
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting.
That's got to be a fair amount, isn't there? There's a fair amount.
Yeah,
because there are lots of very lovely people
on
that.
I have very low standards. And I mean,
but also, these are high standards. I mean, this is high
John
quality.
John Krasinski? I would give up my wife in a second for that man.
Yeah, yeah. Kevin Kline. I mean, it's littered with great names.
Yeah. We're a proud city.
Yeah, well, as you should be. It's a very good city. I like this city a lot.
I'm so pleased to have you here today.
Thank you.
To push the good word on two of your lovely new films, especially considering I thought there might be some ill will considering one of the we haven't talked that many times, but we did have one infamous encounter in which and you reminded me of this.
Yeah.
I'm shocked by your memory, in which I made you play Fuck, Marry, Kill with Hobbit characters.
Yeah. No, because I came in and met you and said, oh, nice to meet you. And then I thought, no, we've met before.
You're that guy that I swore I would never speak to
again.
We
made a stupid game. But no... You have to understand, and I'm sure you do understand, hence you're playing those games, that when in the middle of that sort of junket tour, it's quite a nice breath of fresh air when you just play something childish and stupid.
Yeah. I'm glad you take it that way.
Because at least that's three questions that I hadn't been asked that day. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, wait, I have to actually use my brain.
Yeah,
it's for the most absurd purpose possible.
And it wasn't really about Tolkien. It wasn't really about Middle-earth. It was just about who out of the cast that I would do those things.
To recap, just to let you know, I looked up your answers. The question was Fuck, Marry, Kill for Smaug, an unnamed orc, and I have Sauron. What do you think you answered? Do you have any guesses?
I mean...
Maybe it's changed. You've changed in the last few years.
Well, Sauron is pure evil. I think I said that. He's pure malevolent evil.
Yeah.
Smaug at least has a nice voice.
Yeah.
And is charming.
Yeah.
I might marry Smaug and
you're
kill...
Spot on. You're spot on.
Yeah, kill Sauron and just have sex with an unnamed orc.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Wise then, wise today.
Yeah. If it's good for then, it's good throughout the ages.
I think we're done here today. Thank you for coming by.
You didn't give me a very nice choice, to be fair. That was not a very nice choice.
You should be pleased because your old buddy, I've kind of stopped playing the games in the junket circuit because I frankly felt like there's a certain point where you don't want to be known as that guy.
Mm.
It's fun, but it's also gets a little absurd. But I played that same game with Ricky Gervais for a Night at the Museum film of all things.
Yeah.
And the choices were even harder than yours.
They were
Adolf Hitler, Mao. And that is in fact the sound that came out of Ricky's.
Yeah. Who was the third one?
I can't remember.
Gandhi.
Well, that's funny. You said there were two sets. One was the Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Mother Teresa. That was one set of three. And the other was three dictators.
Three bad people. Oh, wow.
So think about that during the podcast. We'll return to it at the end.
I'm thinking of very little else most of my life. No.
Publicist has nixed it. She's earned her keep for the day.
Yeah, fine. You can keep the ones you have. I'll go with the ones. Sauron. I'll go with Sauron.
You can imagine Ben Stiller's face when I tried that. Didn't work out too well.
which names did you give him?
I gave him all of them, and he was like, checking out. Ricky, it's all you.
Right, okay. It's the part he was born to play.
Exactly. Yeah. So, so you've been doing the press thing. You've probably done the leg in the UK because the film Ghost Stories has come out.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
I saw you share some time with Dwayne the Rock Johnson.
And Graham Norton.
Have you become lifelong friends? I feel like that's a friendship I want to see explored.
He was very nice. I liked him for the little time I spent with him. He was lovely, and my kids were very excited, particularly my son. Because I've done Graham's show a number of times, and my kids are interested. You know, both me and their mum are actors, and you know we're doing okay, thank God. And they like what we do. But when I said to Joseph, I'm doing Graham Norton with Dwayne Johnson, he looked at and he didn't believe me for a fair time because he thought I must be joking.
Right.
He was very excited. So he had Dwayne Johnson and he had Miss Moneypenny, and he was a big fan of Bond as well. So to have Naomi Harris and Dwayne Johnson on. He didn't care that much about Roger Daltrey. That was more my thing. Yeah.
Well,
Roger,
something for everybody.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, for a kid, I would imagine. I mean, Dwayne is like a. He's a living. He doesn't seem real.
No, I'm sure. Yeah, he is like almost like a sort of larger cartoon. Than life. Yeah, he is. He's a big fella, and I'm not a big fella. So when I'm on the sofa with some, like, I did it with Anthony Joshua, a few, you know, the heavyweight champion.
Oh, that's right.
I looked.
That's just not fair.
Both of us look like freaks. I think we both look like we could have been in a Victorian circus.
You seem like a pretty even keel guy. In that, like, do you get excited by meeting people at this point? I mean, you mentioned Daltrey. Is someone like that? Because I know music is a first love for you.
Yeah, definitely. Some people, yeah. And it tends to be. So far, it tends to be more musicians. I'm not looking at my watch. Sorry. How long is this shit going to go on? No, sorry. I felt a bit of fluff.
Uh-huh.
It tends to be more musicians that I get very excited about. But if, you know, I've never met, you know, some of my biggest acting heroes. I met Michael Caine the other week for a short time, and he was without question one of the people who made me want to be an actor as a kid.
Sure.
And I was very pleased to meet him. I was very, very excited. And I sat down. He was sitting with Edgar Wright. I know Edgar. So I came over, said, I'm so sorry to interrupt. And they were very gracious. No, of course, please. It's nice to meet you. I said, and I put my hand out and said, I'm Michael. And he went, no, I'm Michael. That's I was like, yes. So that was clue one, is that I was probably a bit nervous. And he was very gracious and lovely. But listen, if Dustin Hoffman walked in, or if whoever, you know, then I would have a similar musician style thing. It's just music was my thing before anything else was my thing. So,
from reading up on you, it was music. I mean, if anything, acting might have been the third choice beyond music and professional squash player.
Oh, yeah. For a while, I thought I thought I would be a squash player. Yeah, because I loved it and I was very good at it. And I was good immediately at it. And I was a very, very physically fit kid. I trained a lot. I played squash hours a day, and then I was doing circuit training and running and swimming and all of that. And it looked like it was going that way, and I just fell out of love with it in my later on in my teens. And thank God I did, because then I joined a youth theatre in my neighbourhood, and you know, my career as a squash player would have been over at 31, and I would have earned £12. You know, so thankfully there's a bit more
longevity and
a little bit more. Yeah,
well, and relieved also that. Presumably the fire has not gone out in this profession that you've sought. And seemingly, I mean, I can see why having, you know, the nature of what you do is constantly fresh if you're doing it right. And if you've achieved a certain level of success.
Where you can choose. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're lucky enough to be able to choose things and lucky enough to be able to say no more than you say yes, then it's an absolutely joyful job. It really is. It was a good job. It's a lovely way to live and to make a living, you know. And again, I say, not falsely, modestly, if you are lucky enough to make a living, because obviously most people, it's a lot of people doing this job, and most of them are not well off.
Right.
And
some very talented people that are not well off.
Of course, yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's very good fortune to be able to pay the rent. Yeah.
When you were in drama school and you attended in your early 20s, right? I mean, looking back, is there a rhyme or reason to the people that, quote unquote, succeeded, that made a go of it and have achieved whatever level of success? Is it how, you know, when you look back, how much of it is luck and how much of it is sheer raw talent, you think?
I mean, I have to believe, you know, I think we have to believe that some of it is sheer raw talent.
Let's hope.
You know, especially if you're doing well.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're doing well.
In my case, of course, it's that. For the rest of them.
But this asshole is not talented at all. Yes, I think some of it definitely is you.
Yeah.
And some of it is good fortune, of course, and timing and, you know, going in the right door and, you know, meeting that right person who led to that person and 15 people down the line introduced me to Ricky Gervais or whoever, whoever.
I mean, are you a believer in making your own luck and being the...
Yes, without question. And I think, really, I think we all do. I think when we are being very modest... Englishly modest, not Americanly, but when you're being Englishly modest.
You're talking to a New Yorker, a neurotic New Yorker, okay? So I'm the exception. I can go toe-to-toe with you.
When you're being Englishly modest or New Yorker modest. New Yorkers aren't modest.
Well, there are a couple different breeds. You're talking
There's many different breeds,
I walked out of a, like, 1970s Woody Allen film. I literally came off the screen, Purple Rose of Cairo style.
No, fair enough, okay. Fair enough, yeah. Modest to you is something to aspire to.
Yes, exactly, one day.
If you end up being modest, you're being a bit too big-headed.
What an asshole.
So we sometimes we say, oh, it's only luck. It's all luck. Sure. And I think that's just not true. It's not true. Right. You know, of course some of it is luck and some of it is good fortune and the heavens smiling on you. But no, it's your decision-making process. It's how you, frankly, it's how you behave, you know, because you've got to turn, you've got to do it. You've got to do the job.
Right.
And if you're an idiot or not very good or both, then please God, you'll get found out, you know, and that's how we hope those people do get weeded out. They don't all get weeded out.
Right.
Most do, though. So, yeah, it's luck and skill and judgment. You know, it's your taste as well. You know, I'm a big believer in taste and trying to execute your taste.
Is your profession more forgiving to inappropriate behavior? And by that, I don't mean like anything like, you know, literally like, I'm not talking about felonies. I'm just talking about being an asshole. Mm-hmm. Does it reward, hopefully, you mentioned good behavior. You know, generally speaking, the people that come in here are very polite and nice.
I can see from your board, they all look like good people.
They do. Then again, it also behooves them to be nice to me because I'm the one that's going to tell tales.
True. Oh, yes, you're right. He's a prick. Green, five down. I'm kidding. Oh. I'm kidding. That genuinely was a joke because now I'm looking
that's
at Green.
Kevin Kline, I
green
think,
five.
Right?
Green. The third.
Solid green. Five down. Yeah. 1, 2, 3.
And I don't know him at all.
You
and
know
that's
what?
A joke.
Wait,
that was a joke
between the two of us. Honestly, I'm going to say, don't say it. That's the prick on that wall.
You're kidding.
I swear to God.
That's amazing. I am Darren Brown. I am Darren. Who would have thought?
No, seriously, that's. In private company, that's
of
the one.
Course,
when
man.
People ask me,
of
that's
course.
The one.
Well, for the listeners,
anyway,
no. Joe Biden.
We don't.
We don't mean Joe Biden. He's not on the ball. Joe Biden's not.
He
in
was
show
in Parks and Recreation. He'd had a great that, guest
you're
spot.
Right, yeah, yeah, but it's not Joe Biden. We
no,
love
it's
Joe.
Not Joe Biden.
That's so interesting. Because I did. This isn't going out to the public, is it? It's fine. This is just two guys with licorice lollipops in front of them.
Sounds salacious.
It does. Oh, and yours is slightly bigger, but mine's more upright.
It's growing.
And Laura's having another heart attack.
Getting hot in here, is it just me?
It is hot. No, it is.
Okay, good.
It's us. It's the sexual tension. I did SNL a few years ago.
Yes.
And so, and there as well, of course, people talk with sort of encoded ways about who was, you know. And again, this is all, no names will be mentioned,
of course.
Obviously. But yeah, over the years, millions of people have done that show. Mm. And eventually things leak out about, oh yeah, they were tricky, you know.
Right.
Or so-and-so was, you know. Because, and you know what, as it should.
Yes.
As it should. Karmically, it should. Because if people do behave badly, we can all be forgiven one or two. Because, you know, something's happened.
Right.
You may have just lost someone. You might have just be ill.
Yeah.
Whatever. But when it's a consistent thing, I just don't think it's that much of a massive talent to treat people vaguely well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? To be decent to people does not make you a saint. It's not that hard. It's not that hard, you know.
And to go back to our earlier point, there is a great pool of extraordinary talent out there. Why do we need to reward?
I've felt that several times when, you know, if you do something with the possibility of someone who we know is going to be difficult, but there's extenuating circumstances, I'm just like, nah. Life's too short. We could all be dead tomorrow, and I don't want for this to have been my last thing with an idiot. B, as we've established, there are lots of good people. There are lots of people who can do this job quite well, who are not massively famous, who could do with a break, you know. And so why would we tolerate? I don't get it, man.
Has it happened often where you've found yourself, again, without naming names, obviously, you step into a project and day one or two, you're like, oh, God.
It has not happened often, no.
Really?
It's hardly ever happened, to be honest, yeah. Because like you say, you know, the names on you. Most people are. I really think most people are quite decent people. And even from the sort of a profession like actors, which is often quite reviled or at least mocked, you know.
Right.
I think most actors, in my experience, are decent people and just trying their best.
Yeah.
And they might be a bit scared or they might be a bit insecure, but they're decent people.
Now, directors, on the other hand.
Oh, directors!
who do they think they
but
are?
But everyone's trying their best, aren't they?
Yeah,
everyone
is
trying their best. And it has happened to me when I thought I will never work with that person again, but not often.
Right.
Not
and,
often.
And you and Edgar still keep working together.
Yeah, I know.
That's wonderful.
It's because I like his beard. Yeah.
It is luxurious.
Yeah.
Let's mention the films because I want to, and I enjoyed them both. Ghost Stories is delightful.
Thanks.
It's gotten a lot of great reception, I see.
Yeah, it's done really well. I'm glad.
It's both referential yet to a yeah. certain type of film, but also uniquely surprising. I can say absolutely that I was definitely surprised at many turns, many especially around your character.
Yeah.
How often are you surprised by what you see in a script? Can you track sort of where a script is going? And
well, that's a good example of a script that was surprising. And again, in my thank you very much. This is coffee.
He's getting decaffeinated up.
Thank you very much. Caffeinated and caffeinated at the same time.
Uppers
and downers. Yeah.
Exactly.
You do want to be surprised. Yeah. And the amount of times you're surprised is less than the times you're not.
Yeah.
And it's lovely when you get good surprises. And when I read the script of Ghost Stories, it was surprising and scary. I read it a couple of times for clarity, and it was... Yeah, it sent a bit of a chill down my spine about three times in the script. And at other times, I was like just delighted by the surprises. Yeah.
And this is the kind of film that not much needs, I think, to be said, hopefully. We want to kind of give them like just enough to get them excited. Yeah. But, for those that love classic Hammer horror, there's definitely a bit of that in there.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
If you're expecting to see Martin in the first 5 minutes, just be patient when he comes. Were you warned that you're not going to appear for a little while in the script?
Well, Andy Nyman sent me the script, and I knew it wasn't going to be my film, but I was just very happy to be in it.
Yeah
I was very happy to be in it. So, it's by no means my film.
Does this type of film, the tone of a work like this, afford an actor opportunities to, for lack of a better term, go bigger, to
yes.
kind of play in it a little it bit does, of a
absolutely.
Different way?
Without question, yeah. And that's part of the appeal to me as well, because you can lean into certain things, you can be a bit more theatrical, you can, because the film itself is... heightened, I guess, as most horrors are, and certainly most horrors. Well, I say most horrors of this kind. There aren't many horrors of this kind around, actually.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
But they are. Yeah, they're a bit theatrical, and I am afforded the opportunity to be theatrical, without doubt, and that doesn't happen very often.
Right.
So, it's fun to do it. You've still got to anchor it in reality,
sure,
like you have with everything. You still got to have a base of reality, but. What I'm required to do at times is just a bit more up. It's a bit more out there.
When do you feel like most exposed, embarrassed, feel out on your own acting in a script? Whether it's something particular to this one or just generally. Like, is there a stage direction, whether it's like Martin takes off his shirt, Martin screams to the heavens, Martin cries like a baby. Is there one where you're like, oh, God, I'll go there. I'm not going to enjoy going there.
I don't know if you've seen my... It was a film I made a long time ago called Shirt Baby Scream. And I had to do all of those things.
Is that true?
No. It was just a short film, 8 minutes of taking my shirt off, screaming and going, why, God, why? The thing that makes... I think that where I feel most vulnerable is green screen, actually. Potentially, if you're on your own...
Yeah.
There's a scene in Black Panther... where my character is in a sort of a simulated spaceship and he's kind of, bringing down some bad guys. And because that was on my own in a studio just with green all around me, you're just very aware that you could be doing bad acting. I mean, you could be doing terrible acting because you're not reacting to it. Someone's saying, and there's a spaceship behind you, Ryan Coogler is saying, okay, there's one behind you, so you're doing that. Okay, there's one right up ahead. Okay, right. Any time when someone's saying to you, and there's a monster, and here comes the Loch Ness Monster, and now you're drowning, and it feels a bit like a bad commercial casting from on in your career. Do you know what I mean? When you're just asked to do all sorts of things, and you have to trust the director, you have to trust yourself, and the entire CGI and editing process that you won't be exposed. But you're aware that you could be doing some of the worst acting of your life because you're not reacting to something.
Yeah, I'm sure even putting your trust in someone like Peter Jackson or Ryan Coogler, and yes, like, intellectually, they're not going to make me look stupid.
No.
But
still,
in your own heart, you're
going to... When you see yourself back, I am the only judge of really whether I like what I've done.
Right.
Now, so if other people like it or don't like it, that's completely valid. But my opinion of my performance is very important to me. It is very important
really?
To me. I have to, if I go away thinking, oh, God, then that's a terrible feeling. It's a terrible feeling.
How often are the films or projects that are revered by others, mm-hmm. ones that you yourself in your private time mm-hmm. are not necessarily that satisfied.
Well, I love all my work. I think it's all very strong. It's all brilliant. Every time I appear on screen, it's a
magical moment.
It's a gift for an audience. Yes. Yeah. It doesn't happen often. It doesn't happen often that I'm in massive disagreement with people one way or the other, you know, for good or bad. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm quite philosophical about it now. You know, I mean, maybe when I was 25, I would have been a bit more easily thrown. But now I'm 30.
you hit the big 3-0?
Took you a minute. But thank you.
You're you're bathed in oil of Olay. You just seem like supple
now
skin. It's amazing.
I'm 31.
How can you even grow that beard?
This is all stick on.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now I think you get a bit more philosophical that you are... I saw an interview with Dustin Hoffman once where he said, some days it just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. You know, however, whatever you're striving for and searching for, guess what? Some days it will just elude you and you have to be okay with that. And I thought, that's absolutely right. It's really right. And sometimes, of course, like in anything in life, the more you chase things, the more inexplicably gone they are.
Right.
You know? And you can. It's really easy to go down rabbit holes. I can't speak for anybody else, but in my job, to just think, one more, please. I know I've got this thing. And sometimes you're right, and sometimes you're wrong. You know, that sometimes there is nothing else left. It's an empty box.
So now you've gone in the other direction. Now you're one take Martin. You show up on set, be like, guys, I got a game to watch in an hour. Let's just go bang the set. Got some Sudoku to play.
I like being on set, and I'm never happier than when I'm... Yeah, between action and cut, I'm very happy.
Yeah.
Really, really happy, yeah. I love that. I love my job.
Except for the green screen moments, which are maybe... They're fun, but a little less...
Yeah, they're just a bit more... The answer to your question was, when do you feel vulnerable? And that's when you feel vulnerable. I still like them, but they're dangerous because you've got no gauge.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, I guess there were... I was going to say it's Hobbit, but maybe even Hitchhiker. I can't remember... Mm-hmm. Was Hobbit the first time where that experience was like really immersive and you had to kind of like go for broke in terms of dealing with effects?
To that extent, yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think back how much... I don't think there was that much green screen on Hitchhiker's, actually. There wasn't that much. There was some, obviously, but I suppose The Hobbit was the first one where it was that constant.
Sure.
And even then, you know, Peter Jackson's not a green screen geek. He likes things to be physical. He likes real sets as much as humanly possible. He'll build it. You know, he'll get it built. But some things you can't build. Some things do not exist, so you have to digitally render them. But he would rather the real stuff was there, I think, you know. And it's tricky because the most fun thing about acting for me is looking in another human's eyes and building a scene between you. And if you're doing that in front of a green screen, fine. But it's, as I say, it's when you're...
On your own, essentially.
Doing reacting to something that is not there, is never going to be there, has never been there.
Yeah.
That's potentially dangerous,
So backtracking a little bit. I mean, hitting the obvious points that are often brought up in your career. Mm. I mean, The Office came, you're probably approaching 30 around then.
Yeah, I was 29 when I did it, yeah.
Where were you at in your life, career, in terms of... happiness career-wise, personally, were you making a living? Mm-hmm. And did you have visions of a certain type of career then? And if so, what were they?
I was making a living, yeah. I left drama school when I was 23 and I had worked... I'd always worked a lot in theatre, bits of TV, the occasional short film, the occasional commercial. But I was definitely making a living, not a high-rolling living. But... But I was very happy. I was very content.
Were you goal oriented? Was there like, again, you know, we're talking about the danger of always seeking what's next. But that being said, especially in that point in your career, I would imagine there were certain aspirations, whether it's the type of role or a certain level of filmmaker you wanted to work with.
Sure,
what were those kind of signposts for you then?
You know, I don't know if I could have even articulated that then. I'm not sure I can articulate it now. And partly it's because of, you know, don't speak too soon. It's like, you know, as soon as you say it, you'll jinx it. And almost as soon as if you think it, you'll jinx it. Now, I'm aware as well, there is the, I guess, the Jim Carrey school of thought, which is no, you have to say it out loud and visualize it, write it down, and you know that works for him. Yeah. Right. But I think I come from a bit more of a well. As soon as you say something, I feel you limit it, because the part of the beauty of my job is that you don't know because I've done jobs where I had never thought, never occurred to me that I would do that job or that role
right.
until someone went, I really want you to do that role. And you go, oh, fantastic. Whereas if I'd gone, no, I want to do X, Y, Z, you know, and I want that to happen by the time I'm 35, I don't know. It just seems limiting. And it also, to me, seems crazy. It does seem a little bit crazy to me because I just think that even though, yes, you make your own luck, The likelihood, when you start acting, the likelihood you're going to be either rich or famous or both is fucking tiny, right? Almost invisible. It's almost zero, right? So don't, you know...
Why bother spending that psychic energy?
Yeah. And I don't mean not have aspirations right. or drive. I was pretty driven, and I'm highly ambitious to be good. I want to do good work. But it's when you start being specific about it, that feels a little bit to me like a business plan, and it's never felt like a business plan to me at all.
Were you aware before you became well-known and recognizable and famous how much you didn't want that before you got it?
No, I didn't know how much I didn't want it. No. And again, before it sounds like poor me, clearly I have a lovely life, and there are worse things in the world than being famous,
right?
Clearly. But what I found was you only need to be on a couple... If you're of my persuasion, you only need to be on a couple of red carpets with people screaming your name to realise, ah, okay, this is not as much fun as some other things in my life.
Right.
It didn't take long for me to go, ah, right, fair enough. I've seen that now. I've peeked in the curtain and I don't hate it, but you don't love it. Of course you don't love it, because there's not an awful lot to love about that, because there is a kind of, at its worst, there's a kind of mania about it that is not healthy. Human history is littered with examples of when people go, when mania happens, not brilliant things happen as a result. And it's just also, it's my nervous system. I can't take too much of it.
Yeah, I'm a little distrustful of those that are almost too comfortable with it.
I know, but at the same time, I wish that I had, in the last 16 years, got better at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I still don't really know... I still don't really know how to do that. I think I'm better at it than I was.
Yeah.
I'm still not good at it.
I think people just don't recognise... And so let's, again, acknowledge it's a, you know... It's privileged problems, I suppose.
Of course, yeah.
There are worse things. But it is a 24/7 thing. You know, again, you're not Tom Cruise, but I'm sure every day.
Certainly not. No.
But I'm sure every day you are still noticed and recognized, and you have to make that calculation in your head that, like, if I'm going to the grocery store, add in 30% more time than the normal human being.
No, that is true, and you're absolutely right. No, because I think everyone has the I'm not Tom Cruise thing. Do you know what I mean? Because there are gradations of it.
Right.
I am nowhere near the top tier of it. But you don't need to be anywhere near the top tier for it to still massively impact your life.
Did it happen did it feel like it happened overnight with The Office, or was it
a change gradual? Happened overnight, but then it ramped up. I mean, the change happened to me with my ex, Amanda, and I. We went out, we were just going out for a drink in Camden in North London after The Office had first shown. And we were just going to go out. It was a club night on, and it was, you know, soul music. I wanted to go and listen to some music. And it was different. I was like, this is different now. Because it was full of people,
You must feel it. You must feel it. Even if the people aren't, you just feel eyes on you.
Eyes on you, and people were doing the thing. And this is before everyone had an iPhone. You know, no one had an iPhone. Yeah. You know. So not everyone had a camera, at least, but people were making it known. And as I say, not Beatlemania, not Tom Cruise, but still enough that felt like an overnight thing. But then when you do other stuff...
Right.
So it was at that level for a while, and then it stepped up a little bit. With the dual thing of Sherlock and The Hobbit, that was another thing again, you know.
Do you have to put that in part of, like, the algorithm when taking on a project? Because when you take on The Hobbit,
I did. And it wasn't so much... I took that a little bit into account. It was more the doing of it that I... Because obviously it sounds like a no-brainer. Do you want to play The Hobbit in The Hobbit? Yes, of course you do.
Right.
But the bit that... And what I respected Peter Jackson for, I respect him for many things, but the first thing I respected him for, just as a human, was that he understood why I was not just going, oh, yes, please, let me do, you know, let me...
Right.
Because I was a father.
Yeah, you knew enough.
I knew enough, and I wasn't 12.
Yeah, exactly.
And I knew I would have to be away from my family for a long time, at the other side of the world, as far away from London as you can possibly be. He understood that, because he's a family man, and he gets it. That was the bit that gave me pause for thought. It wasn't so much the thing of, oh, my God, now I will always be Bilbo Baggins. It wasn't so much that.
Yeah.
It was just the doing of it. And as I said, I suppose because that sort of the Hobbit-Sherlock thing was part of the same tornado, in a way, in time, they took heat off each other, or they added, you know. Right. So it wasn't like, yes, for some people I will always be Bilbo Baggins, and for some people I will always be John Watson. You know, for some people, I'm meeting the second generation of Office fans now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm meeting guys of like 19, 20 who are going crazy over The Office the way I did over Fawlty Towers or whatever, you know, after the fact. And so that's interesting as well. What's lovely, actually, is if I'm allowing myself pride in something, is that I have done enough roles of varying types that people can go, oh, I really love that. Or, and I'm very proud of that. I'll allow myself some pride in that.
What's all out? what's the overriding like memory or sense memory of The Office at this point? I would imagine, you know, Ricky's cackle probably is burned into your brain forever.
The cackle before it had a trademark on it.
Exactly. You were privileged. You knew the cackle before it became the cackle to end all cackles.
My sense memory is of I have never, ever laughed that much in a work situation, ever. It was truly funny. I knew the scripts were good. I'd met him before. I'd done a sketch show, a BBC sketch show before that called Bruiser, which he contributed to as a writer. I'd met him. I liked him. He was completely unpretentious. He wasn't like any other comedy writer I'd ever met because there was nothing learned or studied about him. Mm-hmm. There was nothing academic about him. He was just like a lunatic who'd been let go in a world full of grown-ups. And I liked that a lot. So by the time I did The Office, I respected him. I didn't know how good he was going to be, but he was phenomenally good in The Office. You know,
what, like these two films you're actually happen to be promoting now, it was a collaboration between two people. Mm-hmm. Both these films are co-directed by Paris, and The Office was obviously Stephen Merchant alongside Ricky,
without question.
Did they have confidence in their own material? They didn't have much of a track record.
They had confidence that no one had any right to have. I mean, it was. Again, only Ricky and Steve know what was in their hearts.
Sure.
But to us, it looked like, who the fuck are these? It was like you had done 15 big shows. Stephen Merchant was about 12 at the time.
Right.
Ricky, I guess, was turning 40. None of them had a track. I mean, Ricky had a little bit of a track record on a show called The 11 O'Clock Show. He'd done little comedy bits.
Yep.
So people in the comedy world started to know him as an entity. Mm. But he was not John Cleese, you know.
You're like, am I missing a page of the resume I should know about?
I know,
with this confidence,
chapter.
Like, what's...
They were completely, it seemed to me, completely confident in their taste and in their skill. And they were right to be, because their taste and their skill was spot on, you know.
How did you and, you and Edgar and Simon get to know each other? You've been in all three of the Cornetto trilogy's progressively larger parts as it continued. How did you guys become friends?
I first became aware of Simon as a performer. I'd seen him on telly, liked him.
He was just here, by the way, a couple of weeks ago, in case you detect his scent or aura in the
yeah,
room.
Right, I knew there was a malevolent feeling in the air. I knew I would like him. Do you know what I mean? I liked what he did. And we had friends in common. You know, we weren't a million miles apart. You know, in that, as you will imagine, you know, Britain being a reasonably small island, we knew people in common. We worked with people in common, and very early on, we people had slightly started to compare us a little bit. Do you know what I mean? And by the time I met him, I was really, because I thought, I think I'm going to like this guy, and I did. He was just a lovely bloke. He introduced me to Edgar at a party, and I'd really liked Spaced.
Yeah.
And I met Simon round about the second series of Spaced. I met him in 2000. And I met Nick Frost at the same time and Peter Serafinowicz and, you know, those people. Because we lived in the same area of London, North London. And, yeah, they were just good people, you know. Yeah. Like, they were just people I liked, who also happened to be very funny and very successful.
Did you share kind of the geek or movie bona fides of those guys? Do you have that kind
of... Not the same. I think there are moments that we cross over. But, no, I'm... I mean, I'm not saying this to make myself look interesting or cool, but I'm not a geek in that way.
Right. Nowadays, you go the other direction. You have to be cool. You have to say that you're obsessed
indeed.
With all stuff.
No, indeed. Well, partly how I knew things had shifted. She's bored. She's gone. It's gone. Not even my publicist gives a shit anymore.
I'm still interested.
Yeah, thanks.
Can't say that for the audience, but...
Yeah, they've all gone. Was it? Yes, oh, yeah. I knew something had shifted, or... Like, Simon, for me, is an example of that... modern popular culture, the way we're sort of obsessed with genre now, the way we're obsessed with, you know, and geekdom and all that, you know, and the geeks have now... They're the cool kids now, you know. Simon has, a genuine, lifelong, as you know, love of Star Wars, right? Now, when I'm a little bit younger than Simon, but those were the first films I loved as well. I loved Star Wars.
Yeah.
But when I met Simon, I realised, oh, no, it's like liking the Beatles and then being a Beatles nut, right? and I'm a bit of a Beatles nut. Mm-hmm. So when people say, oh, yeah, I love the greatest hits of the Beatles, I'm like, why, you little...
you don't deserve to...
Exactly, you don't deserve to hear Agent. And so, yeah, I loved, as far as I was concerned, Star Wars was part of my growing up, definitely partly shaped me, but it didn't shape me into whatever that popular culture version of a geek is, you know.
Fair enough.
And Simon, we would joke about it a lot, that he would talk about Star Wars as if it was 20th century history. Do you know what I mean? Like if it was, if we were reading about the beginning of World War II or something, like it was fact. Because he was naming, whereas I would say, oh, and that bit where that happens, and he would name all the characters and all the moons, around, you know. And so it was a different level. So I think that has shifted in my adult life, actually. I think that, because it's not, it's now not just a case of, oh, yeah, I really liked that. I really liked Back to the Future. It's now, there's a quiz on it, and you have to know the five levels of it, the five layers of it.
Exactly.
And there are some things I can do that about, but they're different things.
Are they? Are any of them in the movies space?
Oh, some of them would be in the movie space, yeah, but what's your comedy space?
Yeah, what's your Jeopardy category in pop culture?
I do anything that isn't music. I mean, I do well on Spinal Tap. I do very, very well on that, yeah. Right. And I do well on... Yeah, TV comedies we grew up with. I do pretty well on The Godfathers, you know. Mm-hmm. I do very well on West Side Story. I do very well on West Side Story.
Spielberg's remaking it. Get your head in the ring.
I heard that, and someone said to me, "It's like who? I'm too old for everyone. I can only play Doc. I'd be a young Doc." But
look, maybe it's mocap. Maybe you could play Maria. True. We don't know. It's too soon to say.
Yeah. It's me and Idris Elba, yeah, just in mocap suits.
Andy Serkis is playing every role.
Every role, yeah. Yeah, no, there are things, obviously, because we all have the things that we love.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, mine isn't, in all honesty, it's not, and as I say, I'm not trying to make myself cool by saying it, but it's not the same.
Right.
There are some concentric circles that overlap, but I'm not as encyclopedic about the same things as they are.
Are there any, you know, your kids are, what, like 8, 10, 10 12,
9,
like
12.
Okay, so so are there films that, does that change your consideration of the kind of films you do, if anything, just to gain some modicum of respect and interest from
sometimes,
them?
Sometimes, yeah. I'm trying to think of recent examples or any examples.
Like, do you call up Simon and say, like, look, if you could put a good word with JJ, that would really help me? Because
definitely, no. I mean, certainly my son would be well into that. I mean, I think in all honesty, I'm not saying that about Star Wars. Obviously, Star Wars is quality. But I don't think I would do something just because Joe and Grace might like it if I didn't love it. But it's very hand... Listen, it's pretty cool if you're the Hobbit when you pick up from school time. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool if you're in Black Panther. You know, that sort of stuff is... Yeah, it's nice when your kids are proud of you, of course, yeah.
Sherlock,
yeah.
This little thing that you're in that some people have some interest in still.
Yes.
I don't see it. I don't get it myself, but no. do you believe in the chemistry thing? Like, do you believe,
yes,
like...
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You and Benedict, and did you experience that from the get-go?
Yeah, we just had chemistry. And you know, I say, and I'm not trying to downplay it. It's almost like not even to. We can't even take any credit for it. It's not like, oh, weren't we clever because we had chemistry? It's pure luck.
Yeah.
Like, that's luck.
Yeah.
Yes, we're good. Yeah, I'm going to say it. We're good at our jobs. You know, we can definitely act. but
going out
so
on
can a lot of people who don't necessarily have their chemistry, you know. Mm. As soon as we started reading, it was, oh, it worked. It just worked. He knew it, I knew it, and the room knew it. It's hard to talk about that sort of stuff without sounding like your own showbiz myth.
Sure.
And then John met Paul. You know, it's not. But it was true.
Yeah.
It was true. We worked very easily and well together. Yeah.
As the clickbait culture has decided that you now hate Sherlock, let's go on the other side and
thank you. I was just talking about that, and I'm gutted about that because, I mean, it's part of the perils of press,
right.
Of course. You do an interview, then they need a headline.
Right.
And a headline was not actually something that I said in the article. So that's annoying. It's also annoying to think that, you know, people I really like and care about,
right,
who we made a good thing together, might have thought, he doesn't like this show. He hates the show.
Did Benedict send you a series of sad face emojis? Like, I thought we were having fun.
What happened?
happened to us.
Well, no, I mean, I hope that people know, because we all do this job, that sometimes things aren't not exactly as what happened in the room.
Right.
You know, and we all know, and, you know, Ben knows that. We all know it. So I hope that... It made me feel weird, that, because it just wasn't true. It wasn't true. What I had said that was true, I have reservations about some of the way that it's received, and that is a pressure.
Right.
That is a pressure. Particularly about the absolute insistence that Sherlock and John are a couple, should be a couple, have always been a couple. And my point was, for the record, me and Ben, given that we're quite good at our jobs, have never... We know what we're playing.
Yeah.
We know the moment, the mood, the motivation we're playing. We never played anything as a couple. And that's just true, you know. We played two friends who love each other.
Yeah.
That's pretty different.
It's weird. We're in a culture now, and I've experienced this many times, talking to people that are in these franchises, et cetera, that are just so... And it's part goes with the territory. So obsessed over that the fans... And, you know, you have to appreciate them because they put...
Of course,
you know, they
yeah,
make
yeah.
it happen.
Yeah, we want people to like the work, of course.
But they
yeah.
almost create... Their own narratives.
They do.
And it's a beautiful thing in some ways, but it's also kind of...
But as long as we know it's that.
Yes.
As long as we know that, okay, that's your own thing. So, if you watch a film and then you think you've created your own universe out of it, that's great. But that's not what Spielberg or George Lucas... As long as you know that that's not their idea, that's fine. I think that's just what became odd for all of us, actually, on Sherlock, the extent to which that happened. Among a pocket of fans, not all fans...
Yeah.
And, you know, because not all people who watch Sherlock are that type of fan.
Right.
Most people who watch Sherlock is just your uncle and auntie, just people who enjoy the show.
Yes.
And there are people who are mad into it. And I love people who are crazy into it because we've all got to be crazy into some things. But it was weird for us when we realised, oh, no, these people, they're running with their own ball now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that is great because, as we know, fan fiction has created a real thriving subculture, you know? And I've read some stuff that is, this is really good. Like, it's well-written, creative, thought-out stuff. But it's not, it doesn't happen to be the show we're making. So it's fine, make your own novels or show, but that's
just
totally
know
fine.
What it is.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not going to suddenly go, do you know what, where Stephen Sondheim was going wrong is with this little tune here. No, it's fine, that's my tune, it's not his tune. And it wasn't meant to be his tune, you know.
Was it surreal to watch, you know, we've talked a lot about fame and deal and that kind of part of it, you got to sort of see it from another end and seeing, like, Benedict then explode and kind of, like, become this obsession for folks. Is that something that you talked to him about or something that you remember was,
well,
like,
We did a bit, but I think because we were both, you know, we'd be on set and it was sort of... We were either in the middle of massive scenes, you know, just where you know what it's like.
There's only a little dialogue.
Exactly, you're too busy working.
Yeah,
or if when we were on location... We sort of, I mean, we would talk about it usually in a sort of humorous way because it would be implicit, because there were hundreds of people watching, you know, in a way that doesn't happen on every job. I mean, that does not happen on every job.
Right.
But there is something about the appeal of Sherlock. And you know, I've been watching them recently with my kids because my kids really like it. And when you haven't seen them for a while, you're reminded of just how good it is, the quality of the writing, the quality of it's just so beautifully shot, the music, everything. It's a good show. Yeah. He's fantastic. He looks great in it. He's fantastic casting as Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah,
he's fantastic.
Can't take your eyes off of him.
No, it's like that. That's a good gig. You know, I don't mean for him, but everyone was a winner with that one. You know, because when I went up for that, to play John, I knew he was doing it, and I was like, yeah. And he wasn't famous then, but people knew him. People in the acting community knew him. And the first time I'd seen him, he was obviously very good. He was playing Stephen Hawking, actually, in a BBC film about Stephen Hawking. And I thought, wow, who's this kid? He's really good. So I already respected what he could do. And I thought, he's a very good idea for Sherlock Holmes. And he was. It just works.
I'll be seeing him this weekend for Avengers Shenanigans.
Really?
Shall I give him your best, or are you guys
please
not talking
do give
anymore?
Him, no, please do give him my best, yeah.
We should mention quickly, Ghost Stories I talked about. Cargo, also an excellent film. Netflix, premiering soon.
Yeah.
This is a tense bit of a, you know, quite a challenge, exciting for you, I would imagine. Mm. A father being put to the test, to say the
indeed.
Limits.
Yeah.
Shot in
Australia.
Pretty amazing locale.
Yes, yeah. Well, in the outback, basically. It was mainly in the outback. In Australia, in South Australia, and I hadn't experienced that before. And it, you know, the backdrop, I suppose, is the mood music of the film is in a post-viral world of zombies. and I suppose the thing that really got me when I read the script was that it was the family thing. It was the father-daughter thing. And it was it's ostensibly about a father trying to look after his daughter with the aid of another girl who they meet on the way, and it's a great first film, I think. You know, Ben Howling and Yolanda Ramke have directed it, and Yolanda wrote it. They did a short of it, some years ago that kind of went viral and did very, very well. So I was sent the link to the short and the screenplay, and I thought this is a really heartfelt. Again, it wasn't just a genre zombie film. It was, as I say, for me, the connection was the family connection. That was what got me about it, and I think they've done it really well.
Let's end on a classy full circle moment. Fuck, marry, kill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, give me some better ones.
Simon Pegg. Ricky Gervais, Benedict Cumberbatch.
Man, I mean, they're all, you know, very attractive man. Oh boy.
Don't ignite the fans.
No, I can't do that because they're people I all know. What? Characters I can do it to. Because if I offend Sauron, who cares?
Okay, we'll go Sherlock.
Okay.
Ricky from The Office, of course.
David Brent.
David, thank you.
Yeah.
Simon's which character for Simon do we do?
well, indeed.
Well, we should do The World's End since that was perhaps your biggest collaboration.
He was annoying in that. The character was annoying in that. Not Simon.
So
Simon's a lovely
impossible.
Man.
Yeah.
You know Simon. He's a delightful person. That Sherlock is brilliant but annoying, you know, as is...
This could apply to
as
all
is
three.
Seen, well, kind of,
well,
yeah.
Well, not brilliant part for David.
Well, yeah, David Brent's not brilliant. Yeah, he's got a good heart, but he's a dick.
You have to murder David Brent. I'm sorry. I'm thinking this through myself. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but...
Yeah, although but maybe. Oh God, but who do I marry? I mean, I think maybe you might have to end up marrying Sherlock. I don't know, because at least it would be interesting.
Yeah,
I think you'd maybe fuck Gary King from The World's End,
right?
Because he's a good time guy for most of the film before he has an epiphany.
Maybe
kill David Brent, but God knows he. Yeah, he is funny. I mean, I don't even mean Ricky's performance, but you would get a lot of pleasure out of being in that man's company just for the
I think he needs to rewatch the show. I don't know if you want to be around that.
That's true. It's true. Yeah, at least Sherlock, he would dazzle you with his intellect at some points, and he's got good clothes.
This has been so much fun for me.
Yeah,
honestly, Martin,
thank you.
Don't be a stranger. Anytime you have something that you need to hawk, hopefully this is one of the less painful stops on a publicity tour. Yeah,
exactly. If it's cutlery.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Who knows where the career takes you? Good luck with all your endeavors.
Thank you.
Everybody, check out Ghost Stories, Cargo, and I'll see you on the next one, man.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
3 To your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.